You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
There's something so triumphant about these classic Christmas carols, something that our people so sorely need in this dark day and age. Ladies and gentlemen, Merry Christmas. This is a first in TPC history that we are live with you on Christmas night. And what an honor and a privilege it is to be with you on any night, but especially Christmas night. And with this, the way the calendar fell this year, our last show of the year. It'll all begin anew. Next week on New Year's Day night, but first we have a lot of work to do this evening, and this is going to be a very special Christmas presentation of TPC. Yours truly and my dear friend and co-host Keith Alexander are going to be looking back on the year that was with our annual Year in Review in the next hour, and then to close out tonight's very special Christmas broadcast, we're going to have Pastor Brett McAtee back with us to share the biblical accounting of the Christmas story, and that will be how we wrap up another year in broadcasting here on TPC. But first, as I mentioned, there is still work to be done, and we had a very special guest planned for you last week. It had to be rescheduled, and we mentioned that, and we are thankful to him that we were able to reschedule him so quickly. He is, of course, Trey Garrison. You got to know Trey when he made his debut appearance on TPC last month in his capacity as a columnist for National Justice, and he was on with us to help break down the Charlottesville trial. But we have been looking forward ever since then to having him back to talk about his book, and that book is Opioids for the Masses, Big Pharma's War on Middle America and the White Working Class. Not necessarily a Christmassy topic, but an important one, and one that we're going to cover right now. Trey, welcome back, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and thank you for having me on again, James.
Well, it's entirely our pleasure, my friend. So, yes, this book, this is something that I mentioned to you when you were on with us a few weeks ago, that this was a topic that is so important and one that I feel we have neglected and one that is often overlooked by our people at large. So, let's get down to it. Why was this a topic of interest for you, and so much so that it led you to write a really definitive book on the topic?
Well, my partner, Richard McClure, and I, it was actually his initial impetus, and he funded all the research. He kind of provided me guidance while I was doing the research and writing. But he and I just had sat down, and we were like looking over some statistics, and normally, you know, a number here or there doesn't necessarily cause your meter to go off. But this was early 2019, and we were looking at the CDC numbers of opioid overdose deaths for the year 2017, which was the current, the most current year at the time of statistics that we had available. And we saw the number 47,000. 47,000 deaths from opioid overdoses in 2017. And normally, sometimes a statistic is like, what's the old saying? One death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. But sometimes numbers like that will really hit you. And for us, we started thinking about this. This was almost as many people, almost as many fighting men as we lost in the Vietnam War over the course of 10 years. It was like 55,000 there, 47,000 deaths in America in 1 year. And so we thought about that for a while, and we realized that And this was at the time that was the peak. That was the highest number that there had been in like, you know, 30 years or so. But just, you know, after we put in perspective like that, we started looking at how little was being done about this, how little funds were available, how there were no, you know, really organized programs coming from the government to fund, you know, getting this fixed, you know, whether it was would involve regulation or treatment or any of these other, you know, all the various avenues you have to go to solve a crisis like this. And we thought about this. If in 1 year, 47,000 people died, 47,000 Americans died, and we called something besides overdoses, we called it, say, terrorism. Do you think that within the next year, we'd still have a problem getting the government to get off its butt and, you know, do something to solve this problem? No. So that was kind of the impetus for it. And our thought was, while, you know, again, I don't want to get dry with the numbers or anything like that or policy things, a bigger part of the story was not just the, what shall I say, the regulatory and government and industry failures. It was really more the stories of the people who were the most affected by it. And, of course, that was the white working class, rural Americans, everybody in flyover country, basically. And, you know, this overly impacted the white working class more than any other demographic. And it wasn't just about the individual stories of deaths, but rather the entire deaths of communities. And we wanted to go in there and actually tell these stories, interweave it with the numbers, interweave it with the policy, but show how this really does impact people, not just on a one-to-one level, but like I said, the entire community is killed by this thing, by this poison.
Trey, and this just is Keith example, Alexander.
Hey, Keith.
Yeah, Trey. Yeah, Trey. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis, and just to help us get our hands around it, is it a Appalachian problem? Is it a larger southern problem, or is it a larger nationwide rural problem, or is it an international problem?
Well, of course, I mean, you know, it has impact, obviously, at the international level, the national level. But what we found is that a very quick avenue for them to get these prescriptions out, to get the addiction started so that they have these lifelong consumers, is in rural America, in Appalachia, particularly with coal mines, in the Rust Belt, throughout anywhere that in where you have a working white class, or white working class rather, you have a lot of manual labor, physical labor, repetitive stress injuries. So people who would never have even thought of ever taking drugs were fine getting prescribed these pills because they were medicine. And that's why, in particular Appalachia, in particular the South, in the, you know, middle America and Rust Belt, that's why this plague has hit so hard on the white working class in these areas.
What about this, Trey? You know,
can't because we got a break. The break's coming up, so we're going to come back to Keith Alexander's question on this Christmas night broadcast of TPC. The book, ladies and gentlemen, put this to memory: Opioids for the Masses, Big Pharma's War on Middle America and the White Working Class. James Edwards and Keith Alexander with the author of this book, Trey Garrison, on Christmas night. Stay tuned. He's with us for the remainder of the hour.
As a parent, is receiving a faith-based, character-focused education for your children difficult to find? Do you believe that godly principles should be a central component in your child's education? Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character. For over 40 years, American Heritage School has been educating both hearts and minds, bringing out academic excellence. This is the school where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. With American Heritage School's Advanced Distance Education Program, distance is no longer an issue. With an accredited LDS-oriented curriculum from kindergarten through 12th grade, your children can attend from anywhere in the world. American Heritage School will prepare your child for more than a job. It will prepare them for life. To learn more, visit American-Heritage.org. That's American-Heritage.org.
Scott Bradley here. Most Americans are painfully aware that the nation is on the wrong track and in dire straits. Unfortunately, most political pundits only nibble around the edges when they claim to address the issues. Even worse, many of the so-called solutions are simply rewarmed servings of what got us into the mess we currently face. And the politicians think we're so gullible and naive that we'll buy their lies that they have reformed and now understand where they led us astray. Unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that they simply wish to continue to hold power. The solution to America's challenges is found in returning to the timeless principles found in the United States Constitution. My book and lecture series will reawaken in Americans an understanding and love of the principles which made this nation the freest, most prosperous, happiest, and most respected nation on earth. Visit topreservethenation.com and order my book and lectures to begin the restoration of this great nation.
Okay, girls, about finished with your lesson on money?
Daddy, what is a buy-sell spread for gold coins?
Well, when you sell a gold coin to a coin shop that's worth, say, $1,200, you don't actually get $1,200. But don't worry, we're members of UPMA now, so we don't have to worry about that.
Daddy, what if somebody steals our gold?
We don't have any gold at the house. It's stored safely in the UPMA vault, securely and insured.
But the S&P 500 outperformed gold. Daddy, gold is a bad investment.
Some people do think of it that way, but actually, gold is money. And as members of the United Precious Metals Association, we can use our gold at any store, just like a credit card. Or I can ask them to drop it right into Mommy and Daddy's bank account, because we're a UPMA member family. Find out more at upma.org. That's upma.org.
Certainly, I think a message that is on point with the topic that we are covering right now. Merry Christmas, Christmas night here on TPC. Never before have we been with you live on Christmas night. Perhaps never again we will be. But we are tonight, James Edwards, Keith Alexander, and Trey Garrison, author of Opioids for the Masses, Big Pharma's War on Middle America and the White Working Class. We're going to talk a little bit more about why it so targets the white working class, particularly. I'm going to ask Trey, after I toss it back to Keith Alexander right now, about the research he did, because he did on-the-ground research that we're going to talk about at length. I think it's really one of the most fascinating aspects of what we're sharing with you tonight. Keith, but first, back to you. You were asking a question of Trey right before we ran up against the wall.
Yeah, Trey, Keith again. Let me ask you, is this opioid epidemic or opioid abuse driven by, you know, a desire like they had in the drug culture in the 60s, tune in, turn on, and drop out? Or are people innocently getting into this addiction when they go to the doctor and want to be treated either for a work injury or for chronic pain?
Well, I think a natural reaction to, you know, drug culture in general is, you know, there's a sense of a, you know, you get on your moral high horse and condemn it from afar. But in the case of opioid addiction, this is not thrill seekers. This is not people looking to escape, at least before they become addicted. The number one vector for most people's introduction to opioid pills is from their dentist or their doctor. And it's for, you know, it's been cracked down on somewhat, but they were getting things out freely for everything from wisdom teeth removal to, you know, maybe your shoulder got dislocated or something and it had to be put back in and you were going to be stiff for a couple of days. They drastically overprescribe these drugs. I talked to a Brandeis professor of pharmacology and pharmacological policy, and I'm sure I've mangled one of those words there, so sorry. I'm more of a writer than a speaker. But he said, you know, he was in addition to being an expert in policy, he's also an MD himself. And he said that, you know, post, say, wisdom teeth removal, almost everybody's had that experience. You might need a day or two's worth of opioid pills to deal with the immediate pain. But after that, a combination of like ibuprofen and Tylenol actually gives you more pain relief without any of the potential side effects and addiction. But no, they were like prescribing like, you know, 30 pills, you know, whatever. And so the impetus for most people who become addicted is not thrill seeking. It is absolutely that they are taking the advice of their trusted physicians and having those prescriptions filled.
Let me just ask you real quickly.
Yeah.
Who is responsible? Is this doctors and dentists that are overprescribing it? And if so, what's in it for them? You know, cui bono? Who benefits?
Well, it's one of the conceits we went into this with was to make this story interesting, even though it was going to be based on, you know, it's all nonfiction, it's all research, it's all actual journalism and reporting. We were going to kind of write it in the style of a murder mystery, as if, you know, here's the body, what happened? And we're going to try to explore that and to make it compelling, because, you know, the best stories in the world, if they're not told well, never get read. So we went into it with that attitude, and it turns out by the time we were done with it, it was basically Murder on the Orient Express, the Agatha Christie novel, where everyone is responsible. The regulators, the big pharma, obviously, the doctors, the pharmacists who are, you know, pharmacies that are filling prescriptions for like 10 million opioid pills in a year in a town of 4,000 people.
Wow.
So, yes, there was a collective guilt across the board.
Trey, I got to ask you this because, again, this book would have been very and vitally important had you simply done what most authors do, and that's head to the libraries and do research and then put forth a book. But you went far well and beyond that. You spent 9 months on the road. When I read this, my eyes popped, primarily in the South, in Appalachia, the Rust Belt, and in the Midwest, and those towns and counties hardest hit by this opioid crisis that we're talking about. You talked and met with cops, with junkies, with drug court judges, doctors, pharmacists, and the local residents trying to get the story of how this crisis had not just harmed people, but families and communities. So let's talk about that for the next 2 or 3 minutes before the break. What were some of the most memorable and stirring encounters that you had as you talked with the people affected by this one-on-one in the streets of their communities?
I think that you know, to tell the story, you had to like actually talk to the people who were most affected and actually spend time with them, not just like, here's a phone call, here, tell me about your troubles, and then you're done. You actually have to live with them. You have to, you know, deal with what they're dealing with. And I met people who, by all rights, should have given up hope, who in turn had gotten their lives straight and were like dedicating themselves to getting other people well. I met cops who just were not going to play the game of let's just get the numbers, the arrest numbers up. That means we're solving the problem. They actually recognized that this was a plague on their community, and it wasn't just about busting the dealers. Yes, you want to do that. Yes, you want to bust the pill mills. But you actually, if you're going to solve the problem instead of just the symptom, you have to take a more holistic approach. So I met some really heroic cops who were absolutely not anything like the stereotype that's out there in the media, people who actually cared about the communities. And what was most amazing to me was when I was off duty, when I was like spending my own time, like having coffee or dinner or something like that, or having a drink at a bar, almost everyone I met, when they said, well, you know, what are you in town for? And I'd tell them about what I was doing. They said, yeah, I had a cousin who overdosed. My brother overdosed. Every single person, without fail, had a family member or a friend who had suffered an overdose, if not an overdose death. And it was absolutely amazing to see how this pervasive this was. And we wouldn't have known this. We wouldn't have really gotten a sense of that had we just stuck to, you know, parachuting into a small town for a day or two. And then, you know, oh, well, we got the story now. No, we actually had to see the impact, the devastation on their lives and on their communities.
Yeah, Trey, now who were the manufacturers or pushers or whatever on this? Were doctors making money over-prescribing? Was the source exclusively Purdue Pharma, or what is and the Sacklers? Or tell us about that. Well, it's again, who is benefiting from all these addictions?
Well, everyone down the line, basically. Purdue Pharma is one of the biggest producers of opioids, particularly OxyContin, which most people are familiar with. But there were several other huge pharmacy companies. Basically, the Purdue Pharma spent their time in the 60s and 70s perfecting the advertising of these to individual consumers. They started with Xanax and other like sedatives marketed towards the suburban housewife in the 60s. But they also would buy up medical journals.
Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones, remember?
Yes, exactly.
Hold on right there, gentlemen. We're going to take another break. You can get the book at Amazon.com. We're going to get Trey to tell you exactly where he would like for you to get it from. But that's one option. Opioids for the Masses by Trey Garrison. Be sure to check it out, and we'll continue to talk about it more on this Christmas night presentation of TPC right after this quick break.
Proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
A large explosion took place hours ago at the ExxonMobil refinery in Baytown, Texas, after what local sheriff's deputies called a major industrial accident. At least four people were injured, according to the Harris County Sheriff's Office. Baytown is located east of Houston, Texas. The Exxon refinery was built in the 1920s and is the company's largest oil refinery in the United States. The Supreme Court announced it will hold oral arguments on January 7th to consider legal challenges to President Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandates. CDC Director Dr. Walensky explains why COVID testing kits are in short supply.
The administration is doing a lot with regard to testing, and we recognize we have more work to do. So that, of course, includes a $3 billion investment in rapid tests.
Unfortunately, the kits won't be available till well after the holidays. Merry Christmas to you, my friend. We are USA Radio News.
You may be into punk rock, soft rock, or classic rock, R&B, hip-hop, or house, country, techno, or techno country. But no matter what kind of music you listen to, here's something else you should hear. Please consider getting vaccinated. Talk to your pharmacist today about Comirnaty, COVID-19 vaccine mRNA. This message brought to you by BioNTech and Pfizer.
I'm Dr. Baker, an ER physician. If you're having leg pain, swelling, or redness, but haven't talked to your doctor yet, don't wait. This could be deep vein thrombosis, a blood clot which could travel to your lungs and lead to a pulmonary embolism, which could cause chest pain or discomfort or difficulty breathing and be deadly. Your symptoms could mean something serious, so don't wait. Talk to a doctor right away, by phone, online, or in person.
Brought to you by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
The president has paused student loan payments once again.
President Biden has extended the pause on student loan payments another 90 days to May 1st. The pause had been scheduled to expire at the end of January, and what the administration had said was the last extension it was going to offer. But the rise of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 led some Democratic lawmakers to ask for another extension. From the USA Radio News Phoenix Bureau, I'm Tim Berg.
China is redoubling efforts to control new virus outbreaks with the lockdown of 13 million residents of the northern city of Xi'an following a spike in coronavirus cases. The measure comes just weeks before the country hosts the Winter Olympics in Beijing, roughly 625 miles to the northeast. There was no word on whether the virus was the newly surging Omicron or the far more common Delta. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We are USA Radio News.
They're singing about this night, Christmas night, and I'll tell you, the voices of angels couldn't sound more heavenly than the voices of those women, our women. And welcome back to the show this Christmas night. I'm glad we get to play beautiful hymns like that on a night such as this, but I'll tell you that during the break, Keith Alexander and I went and listened to Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones. If we'd had Trey on any other night but tonight, I think we might have come back with that. That certainly, that was back in the 60s and 70s, of course. Certainly paints a vivid picture about what's going on here and now. Trey, let me ask you this, and I don't know how much of this you may have run into or if you even believe this to be part of the problem, but we see, as this affects so many people, particularly in the white working class rural communities, but of course not exclusively those people, this incessant drumbeat of demoralization towards whites, as we are taught from cradle to grave that our people are worthless and evil and have contributed nothing of worth to society, and that our people should be ashamed of who they are. Has that psychological conditioning played a role in the addiction that many of our people, and the despair that perhaps have been falling into?
It's despair driven. That's exactly right.
Absolutely. Time and again, when I was talking to people, particularly, I think in Ashland, Kentucky, this really came up, where one of the sources I developed was a local activist on the opioid issue. And she, in particular, said, you know, people have no sense of identity. They don't know their roots anymore, or they're told to be ashamed of them. And, you know, obviously that's not the only thing, but it hugely contributes to, once you have become addicted, just seeking that out because, you know, you have no other meaning, you don't have identity, you have all these other things taken away from you, your community, the economy's in a toilet, wages for the working class have been stagnant since the 1970s. You have all these other problems piling up, and then not even having a sense of your identity, or feeling that if you do have a sense of that identity, it is only because you feel guilt over it. That absolutely contributes to the deaths of despair.
Well, Trey, this is Keith again. You know, affirmative action probably plays a role in this despair. The smart white kids aren't getting into select colleges and universities that lead to lucrative careers. Also, the outsourcing of America's manufacturing base to the Pacific Rim. It used to be that almost every little town in Tennessee, we're in West Tennessee, had a major factory there that was either a garment factory or an appliance factory or something like this, air conditioners factory and things like that. And that was the basic go-to job for rural people. Now I understand that almost 70% of the male heads of household in rural America have one occupation, truck driver. And, of course, truck driving means you're away from the family most of the time, you know, driving to California or whatnot. Is there a connection now between that and the despair, or is it something else that we're missing?
Absolutely. Through Appalachia, the Rust Belt, that was a very common theme. In fact, I one of the places I started with research was in Jasper, Alabama. I know James knows that area. I was actually surprised to learn for the first time in my life that it had formerly been a coal town, but somewhere in the 1990s, the coal mines had shut down. And it had sent the local economy into the, you know, into the tank, and it had struggled ever since then to try to recover. And then come around 2015, because of where energy prices were, a company came in and said, we want to reopen the coal mine. We can provide 500 direct coal jobs. And when you think about the impact on a community of 500 jobs, it redounds more like three times that amount of support jobs and how it will revitalize the community to have all these jobs here. So you'll have more additional
retail. If the head of the household has a job, then he's supporting his whole household, which might be four or five people.
Exactly. The problem was they went to do drugs. They took applications and did drug tests. They couldn't find 500 people who were qualified for these kind of coal jobs who could pass a drug test. So they canceled the plans. I mean, this was the death of a community, doubly so. It had already been hit, hard by the loss of the jobs and, as you said, reduction in the, male-led households working for like a good blue-collar wage, a good job. You know, coal mining is hard, but it pays well, and it's something that, it's accessible to most white males. And,
I didn't mean to interrupt, but we're going to circle back in the final segment in a couple of minutes and just refocus on the importance of this message and why people should care. If we haven't pinpointed it yet, we will. But let's talk quickly, if we could, for maybe one or two minutes here about solutions. Documenting it, understanding it, realizing the importance is obviously a prerequisite.
Or is it beyond correction now? Is rural America in a death spiral because of this?
I think you could easily say everybody stop taking these drugs. It's probably not that easy, though.
Oh, sure. We've known about the dangers of opioids going on hundreds of years. We could have policies that would restrict their supply. We could have drug interdiction. But what is driving this, what has really killed the soul of rural America and middle America and the white working class, is that the entire system is basically oriented against them. They know this. When you feel like you're born and you're immediately guilty and there's going to be a ceiling to anything that you can accomplish, and there's going to be the worst expectations upon you at all times, that contributes to the despair. And only other government policies like outsourcing jobs, closing down coal mines because of, energy policy, green energy crap. All of this contributes to that despair felt by just the average man, the normal person in middle America. And that is what is driving this addiction as much as, it was introduced, it was forced upon people, but now that it's there, now that
it's a coping mechanism for people that are in despair, right?
Exactly. Now that the seal's been broken, and now people who two generations ago would have chased you out of the holler with a shotgun if you ever suggested they should inject something in their veins, now see this as just a normal alternative and coping mechanism for the crap that their life has become because of government policy, not because of any other reason.
Well, critical race theory, like you said, may have something to do with it. Also, there have to be other factors. What about the decline of the public education system? We used to be, in 1954, number one in the nation, our public education system was. Now it's number 37. So they're not getting educated.
And there may
they're not getting educated for jobs. There aren't jobs to be had for a person that was, a typical manual laborer in the past, or a guy that worked with his hands, a blue collar guy. So all of these things are driving people to try to cope with sadly diminished and diminishing prospects in life.
It's interesting, Keith, that you brought up the education, because I was just thinking, listening to trade talk and your question earlier, who benefits? I think there are certainly probably some entities that benefit from having a dumbed down and drugged up population. A dumbed down and drugged up population is certainly very easily, or much more easily, controllable. Would you agree, Trey?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the premise for Brave New World, right? That was the idea of providing, the equivalent of bread and circuses, but now it's drugs and television, and free internet, and all that. If you were a ruling class, how would you not benefit from having a docile and drugged out population who will go along with what you say, because you pretty much control the purse strings on everything now?
Well, you know, the establishment seems to be working on people's vices. Tune in any sports station, radio station, or the TV. It used to be taboo to talk about gambling, betting lines, and stuff like this. Now they have whole shows devoted to that. See, and they're exploiting a weakness to make money. They're exploiting the vice of gambling. So drug addiction is another one.
Trey Garrison is the author. The book is Opioids for the Masses, Big Pharma's War on Middle America and the White Working Class. You can find it at Amazon. I'm going to get Trey to tell you more about it in this next and final segment with him on this Christmas night broadcast of TPC. Stay tuned, everybody.
Why don't we say to the government writ large that they have to spend a little bit less? Anybody ever had less money this year than you had last? Anybody better having a 1% pay cut? You deal with it. That's what government needs, a 1% pay cut. If you take a 1% pay cut across the board, you have more than enough money to actually pay for the disaster relief. But nobody's going to do that because they're fiscally irresponsible. Who are they? Republicans. Who are they? Democrats. Who are they? Virtually the whole body is careless and reckless with your money. So the money will not be offset by cuts anywhere. The money will be added to the debt, and there will be a day of reckoning. What's the day of reckoning? The day of reckoning may well be the collapse of the stock market. The day of reckoning may be the collapse of the dollar. When it comes, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you it has happened repeatedly in history when countries ruin their currency.
You know where the solution can be found, Mr. President? In churches, in wedding chapels, in maternity wards across the country and around the world. More babies will mean forward-looking adults, the sort we need to tackle long-term, large-scale problems. American babies in particular are likely going to be wealthier, better educated, and more conservation-minded than children raised in still industrializing countries. As economist Tyler Cowen recently wrote, quote, by having more children, you're making your nation more populous, thus boosting its capacity to solve climate change. The planet does not need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. The solution to so many of our problems, at all times and in all places, is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids.
If the COVID-19 shot is safe and effective, then why are 20% of healthcare workers refusing to get it? If the COVID-19 injection is safe and effective, then why is big tech silencing anyone who opposes it? If the COVID injection is safe and effective, then why is our federal government's reporting system recording over 14,000 deaths from the vaccine and an additional 650,000 plus serious adverse reactions? If the COVID shot is safe and effective, then why did Dr. Geert Vandenbosch, recognized as one of the world's chief vaccine experts, risk his entire career and his reputation to plead with the medical community to immediately halt all COVID-19 vaccinations, calling mass COVID vaccinations an uncontrollable monster? Doesn't sound very safe and effective. Maybe it's time to call a spade a spade. At no time in history have the people forcing others into compliance been the good guys.
Paid for by Ammon Bundy for governor. VoteBundy.com.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see the light above thy deep and dreamless sleep. The silent stars move by, yet in thy dark streets shine the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee.
That was, as Keith mentioned, the man from Memphis, or Tupelo, actually. But In any event, welcome back. Let us all be resolved in the coming year to be healthy, to be fit in mind, body, and soul. And we're talking about a very big problem that is afflicting our people with Trey Garrison right now, author of the book Opioids for the Masses. I'm going to read now from the promotional page of this book. This is an important message. When does a crisis become a crime? More importantly, who are the victims? In this investigative tour de force, Trey Garrison and Richard McClure delve into the human stories behind the epidemic, which has killed over 400,000 Americans since 1999 and destroyed the lives of millions more. Down winding roads and up beautiful mountains, the journey into this modern heart of darkness is narrated with grim detail and interspersed with research giving systemic context to personal stories. That's what we've been talking about tonight. Throughout it all, rays of light shine through in these accounts of the courage, perseverance, and dignity of those who have overcome or are fighting back against a force so much stronger than themselves out of love for their people. Well-sourced and hard-hitting, this book is a must-have for anyone who wants to learn more about the sad state of the forgotten man. And at a time when good journalism is the exception to the rule, especially when victims are rural whites, these authors provide a sobering look into the opioid epidemic. This is Trey Garrison, again, author of this book. Trey, where would you encourage people to go to get it? We mentioned Amazon being one of the carriers. Is there anywhere else you would like them to go?
Oh, absolutely. My publisher, the good people at Antelope Hill Publishing, it's antelopehillpublishing.com, put together some of the best stories, the best translations, the best both fiction as well as nonfiction. But it's antelopehillpublishing.com, and you can get it directly from them, and it's like, I think, 15% cheaper than what you'll find on Amazon.
Excellent. I'm glad I asked. Antelope Hill Publishing. I'll tell you what, Trey, if you can text me, well, I can find it, I'm sure, but if you can text me a link, we'll put that up on our Twitter homepage. So anybody listening tonight or perhaps in the broadcast archives after tonight, I realize, you know, some people may have other things to do on Christmas night, but when you do catch this interview, whether you're listening to it live or after the fact, you just go to our Twitter page and we'll have you the direct link there to the publisher itself, Antelope Hill, who has done fantastic work. If you're not familiar with the work of Antelope Hill Publishing, folks, go check out their entire portfolio, their entire catalog of books and authors. Really fantastic publishing house there. And we'll get Trey to send us that, and we'll post it up. So check it out at Twitter. Now, I would ask you this, Trey. I think that our listeners probably won't have to go too deep into their roster of family members and friends to find someone who has been touched by this crisis. I certainly know people who have, very near and dear to me. So I think that would probably answer the question immediately. But for people who say, well, you know, I'm not on drugs, this really hasn't affected me, why should they too care?
Well, it's a sickness of society. There's a problem in the larger picture. When you have so many people on medications, whether it's escaping through opioids or on antidepressants, antipsychotics, when the majority of your population are on some kind of prescribed medical drug, the problem really isn't with the individuals. There's something wrong with society. There's no reason that a society, a healthy society, would not have a huge a majority of the population on prescription drugs. Absolutely. And it's, I'm sorry, but, you know, you may think that you don't have a family member or a friend who's had this problem, who has been touched by this poison, but, you know, we generally do not have anybody in our lives who has not struggled with this in some way or another. That was what I found on the road. That's what I found through personal stories. That's what I found through networks. This thing has impacted somebody you know. They may not have overdosed, but they dealt with the addiction and the struggle there.
Trey, Keith again. It seems like when you have no prospects for self-improvement or societal going up the social ladder economically, that you fall prey to a variety of vices. And I think the elites know this, and that's why they are exploiting all of these. One would be drug addiction, that's a vice. Another is alcoholism, that's a vice. Gambling is a vice. Pornography is a vice. Every vice now is big business. in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that it's an accident. You know, everybody has their Achilles heel. You may not be subject or vulnerable to drug abuse, but on the other hand, you know, there are so many vices, they'll find a way for you to get hooked on something that will even, you know, dig the hole deeper for you economically.
That's a great observation, Keith, and that's something that Trey just mentioned, and I think that is the reason. Even if I doubt there's anyone listening who doesn't know someone who has fallen victim to this to some level. But we have to have healthy societies, and we have to care about our fellow man because our race is our extended family. If you don't care about the well-being of your family, what kind of person are you? Certainly, we need to care about the health of our communities and our fellow kinsmen and our societies at large because we're not just fighting for the present. We're fighting for our futures as well, and you don't want a drug-addled society that your kids will be raising their kids in.
Yeah, result of this despair, too, I think, is the reduction in white birth rates ever since the beginning of the civil rights movement. It just, you know, it used to be that having children was an economic benefit. And when that is true, you have plenty of children. You know, back in the days of rural America, a new baby was another pair of hands, another free farm laborer. Now, with the decline of public education, having children is a burden. And there are a lot of people that just can't cope with all. Well, we do not have a family-friendly society anymore. We have everything that you used to be able to rely on to help you on your way financially, like good schools, like good jobs. They're disappearing, and people are constantly turning more and more. They're falling prey to various vices.
Well, the nuclear family is being attacked on so many fronts, it's almost impossible to name them all. This is certainly one of the mechanisms that is being used to destruct and deconstruct the nuclear family.
And of course, it's going to drive those families that have an adult parent addicted to opioids even further into poverty.
Let's give our featured guest of the hour, Trey Garrison. Trey, listen, I want to tell you again, Merry Christmas, and thanks for being on with us last month. Really have enjoyed working with you over the course of these two appearances. Looking forward to much more collaboration in the year to come. We want to give the final word to you, my friend. Anything we've left out that you'd like to share with the audience about this book and this, again, this very important
topic?
Or
your experience.
Like I said, this impacted me very directly. I spent one night. This is not something you normally do as a journalist. You don't get involved with the people that you're developing as sources, people that are really the heart and soul of your story. You have to, you know, normally maintain a distance. But I spent one night, the whole overnight, in an ER or an ICU unit with a source I've been developing. She was very cognizant of the opioid crisis and was working on it, various policy issues. And her daughter overdosed. And it was going on right under her nose, even though she knew, you know, all the problems and all the signs. And I spent the night holding her hand. And I feel like that we are able to tell this story in a way that's more compelling because we kind of just threw those rules out the window. We really wanted to tell the story about our people and how they were being impacted, how they're being attacked, how this is the direct result of policy. This is not an accident of history or a moral failing by any single person or group of people. This was policy. This was inflicted upon the white working class. And so, yeah, we are, I think, because of our passion for this subject and passion for our people and our care for, you know, the future of white people, we were able to tell a better story.
Let me ask you this,
so I hope that comes across in the pages.
One more thing. What is the relationship between fentanyl and opioids, or is there one?
Well, fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It's so ridiculously more powerful than refined opium or morphine or, you know, laudanum or any of the other various forms of opioids, much less the pills. Contact exposure to fentanyl can cause an overdose. I have actually dealt with cops who, when they opened a trunk and there was fentanyl inside the trunk of the car, just being close enough to it, they went into an overdose and they had to be Narcan.
That's incredible. I did not know that.
And that's becoming, it's becoming kind of a go-to now. They use it, they mix it with the existing product. to you know, to spread it out. But it's more addictive. It's more deadly. We're talking about kitchen scientists. We're not talking about real scientists. So there's no regularity to the strength of it. But it's,
there's no legal fentanyl in the other words, right? There's no. It's not like an opioid.
Well, it is used for certain extreme cases of. It is a medical. It is used as a pharmaceutical. I think they give out like fentanyl lollipops in the military, you know, for people who are injured, like with their arm falling off or, you know, their leg blown off.
Ladies and gentlemen, out of time, but Antelope Hill Publishing, check out the book Opioids for the Masses. Trey, listen, what an incredibly informative hour. Thank you again. Thank you for your work. We'll talk to you again in the new year. We'll be back with more right after this, everybody.